Welcome, everybody, to Theory Underground. I'm your host, David McCarricker, and of course, here's Nance. We've both been here today for the Epic Marathon live stream. But this segment is actually pre-recorded. This is the Saturday before, and we are joined by Nina, Wukoc, Cadell, and Carl. Great to have you all here. Welcome. How's it going, everybody?
Great.
You know, fantastic.
It's amazing. It's that Zoom leg, because everybody's got to unmute and then remute, you know. Well, what you see on the screen here, everybody, is the newest draft of the American Idiots EU Book Tour 2024, where we are going to be going to Paris, Brussels, Berlin, Vienna, Linz, Krakow, Glasgow, London, and Oxford. Now, about half the participants or organizers for these various events are either present or are represented. And so really what we wanted to do in this conversation is just talk a little bit about some of the events that we'll be doing at these various stops. But first I'll say something about the title, let Nance say whatever he thinks is important information that should be added to that. And then we'll probably just let each person kind of introduce themselves, and then we'll linger a little bit with Nina because she's got to leave first. And then we'll just go from there, and this will be about a 50-minute segment. But basically, the American Idiots Tour, it's titled obviously after that Green Day song or an album, and the amazing artwork here was done by Luke, who's a subscriber at Theory Underground. Instead of a grenade in the hand of the fist, it is a brain, and over the brain is the time energy symbol, which, you know, over the last year of finding out about chaos magic, people have been teaching me is actually also a sigil. I didn't know that, but it is apparently. And so that's what's over that brain. And the two books in the bottom right-hand corner, Underground Theory and Time Energy. Well, Underground Theory has pieces by Nance, myself, Nina, and Cadell in it. And of course, it opens a whole field of anthologies to come that will hopefully include works by people like Wukoc and Carl, or people who are presenters, organizers, participants at various stops along this tour, because this tour is not just a book tour, it's also kind of like a distributed conference that is going towards future anthologies. And so last thing I'll say about it for the people who don't have eyes on screen is that on the wrist, or the arm, I guess, of the fist that's holding the brain, it says, workers intellectualizing anti-intellectualism. And so the idea is, like, we're American idiots. We don't want to be, but anti-intellectualism is one of the symptomatic major exports of the United States. And, you know, it just kind of comes with neoliberalization, of course. But we'll be talking about the causes, the drive, that reaction, because that is a legitimate reaction from regular working people. It's a legitimate reaction. And so that's kind of the theme, and we'll get into it. But Nance, what would you want to add to that?
Yeah, just calling it American Idiots. It's fun. It may be sensational. It may shock people. I mean, if Dostoevsky and von Trier and even Byung-Chul Han can use the word, we can use the word too. But yeah, I think performing this thing where it's like, I'm an idiot. Nevertheless, I want to learn more. I want to expand my mind. There's so many people in my life, in my family, that just say, well, I'm an idiot, so I'm not even going to try. So I think, yeah, man, we're going to champion our idiocy. We're going to champion our journey up to the top of the mountain. And I'm excited.
And we also defend the right for people to say, I'm not going to try, and I'm just going to work my job and live my life. And the fact is not everybody should have to do the work, right? That's another big part of what we're pushing. But with that, let's all just like introduce ourselves, and we'll just go according to the order here. Nance and I can maybe say something about ourselves, but this is the channel we're always on. So I think at this point we probably don't have to, but we'll just go Nina, Wukoc, Cadell, and Carl, you can talk about how you got involved and kind of how you're going to be participating and the various stops along the tour that we'll be meeting you.
Okay, so I'm Nina. Power. I am senior editor at Compact Magazine, which is based in New York. I was an academic for 13 years, and I want to say, first of all, stay away from chaos magicians and chaos magic, whilst okay, good. Also maintaining touch with the signifier. and its, mysterious and elusive nature, and be playful. But I think there's enough chaos already, right-hand path only, magic-wise. I think this question, actually, you're raising about who is an idiot. Like, the idiot originally is just someone who is outside the city, right? It's somebody who is, like, not buying into the doctrine, the dogma, like, the convention. And, you know, all of the great thinkers really... from Diogenes and Socrates, actually, and they're like inverted versions of each other, but are at odds with the doctrine. And I think this is like a totally necessary and honorable position for anyone who's thinking, as we all are. So I think the idiot is like a deeply, you know, heroic figure. And I have to say, as somebody who spent a lot of time with members of the PMC, the professional managerial class, and people who are supposedly educated and actually from very cultured backgrounds, like, a lot of these people are very, very stupid, you know what I mean? Like, literally stupefied. Like, they are careerists, they're materialistic, they are cowardly, they're not actually that interested in thinking. So I'm very supportive of, as I say every time I'm on your stuff, like, of all of these kind of para-academic, post-academic, anti-academic projects, you know, precisely because, as Spinoza says, people think, right? Like, this is reality. And, you know, it's this division of, like, the idea that it's middle-class people or whatever who can think is just absolutely nonsense. So I think Reclaiming the Idiot is a fantastic project. So I'm speaking at the London event, which is May the 24th, at my friend Pierre's new place, I guess, called Verdurin, after the Proust salon host. And it's actually very exciting that we have this space now, because obviously we're kind of cut out of many places, like in the art world, and a lot of us are sort of persona non grata for lots of reasons in conventional and institutional places. So it's very, very good to have somewhere where people can hang out and talk and think together collectively without fear of, you know, being kind of whatever, punished for this kind of thing. And really, like, in a seminar, people have, in a way, almost like a duty to get things wrong or to explore things. And that's become quite difficult in lots of places where people are, like, afraid to experiment with ideas, or just to say something that's stupid or idiotic. And we should bring that back. So just briefly, I'm going to be talking at Pierre's probably about the use of affective language in politics in recent years, particularly around concepts of hate. And I want to do a talk on the dialectic of hate. And I think the way in which this word and this very powerful accusation is used, and how it's actually used to shut down thinking. But it's kind of complicated, because where we situate hate in ourselves, and we're all capable of it, is becoming, I would say, very in tension with, like, the law, like the nomos, right? So we're having all this massive expansion of hate speech legislation. And it's one of those things, like, we sort of know what it is, we sort of know what hate is, but the law sort of doesn't know what it is, and yet it's kind of invoking it. And it's something that we're, like, often very afraid of, and we don't want to be thought of as a hateful person. Everybody wants to be kind, but, like, we're in this really tricky affective, emotional, political universe, and I suppose I just want to unpick some of those. So that's my topic at the moment, but it might shift a little bit between now and then. But I'm very happy to be involved, and look forward to it.
Awesome. And then, yeah, at that event, Helen Rollins will also be there, and she will be talking about her own intellectual journey, how she went into sort of, I think she described it as a kind of hippie phase where she was very anti-intellectual, and then through psychoanalysis got involved again. And but ultimately, this is not supposed to be a gripe session about, you know, oh, everyone's anti-intellectual, or oh, we want to be intellectual. It's going to be more, yeah, like Nina just modeled, it's going to get a lot more into these various aspects of that picture that usually go left untouched. And so really excited about that. Let's just, since we already have the poster up, break the order I had initially said and say, you know, Carl, you're right there. Your Museum of Consciousness project that you're working on, and this awesome spot you got for us at Balliol College at Oxford University. Wondering if you could say how you got involved with that, and maybe a little bit about your research and how this project came together.
Yeah, thanks, Dave, and thanks for inviting me into this. So, yeah, my research is primarily focused on consciousness and the exploration of it. And I think it's for me something that it's our birthright to explore our consciousness, and a lot of people kind of are Netflixing themselves to death. I still think that things like sound and the universality of music really has the power to democratize the altered state. And I think what we're missing is deep listening. Deep active listening doesn't seem to happen anymore. And I think that if you can learn that skill, you can like build that muscle. It can universally help you across the board, and you can apply it. So I think for me, the Museum of Consciousness came out of the pandemic, where everyone was so visually overloaded, mostly with their own image, being on Zoom and constantly like in this narcissistic gaze, being forced to look at yourself all day. And so this was again about bringing people together to shut their eyes, to have the permission to shut their eyes, and to go into their own imaginations. And I'm really motivated by, you know, the cold media that McLuhan talks about, where it's like you build the co-collaboration of the experience, because you're filling in the blanks, whether it's like with radio or with reading. You know, there's so much more, there's so much space for you to have that declarative impact on the product, rather than the typical CGI film where everything's done for you and it's like popcorn. You know, it's very, very, it's like hot media. So what is it that we're going to be doing in the Museum of Consciousness? This particular episode is going to be around the consciousness of time energy. You know, what is it about time that's so plastic? Why is it when we get to 75, you know, the years between 75 and 80, we age 5 years for every year? You know, and I think that it's a fascinating thing, time, and the relationship between time energy, as you've so eloquently mapped out, I think is a fantastic subject to have as a consciousness museum exhibit. So we'll bring together five philosophers to talk about it. And the way the structure is that we have a transmission, which is your pitch. And then, you know, we have a Q&A, so people can say what impact on consciousness your pitch had on them. And then there's a mini lecture from each philosopher to talk about their umwelt, their life world. So, yeah, I think that it's all around democratizing altered states. My work is very much in that zone.
Thanks, Carl. Yeah, we're really excited about this. The Cadell is going to be one of the philosophers doing a transmission. You will be doing a transmission. I will be doing a transmission. Nance will be doing a transmission, as will my wife, Anne Snellgrove McCarricker, who is in the other room doing sociological research interviews right now. And so she wasn't able to be here because it was all double booked out this weekend. But she's here with us in spirit and is totally honored, as are we, to be at this like prestigious, you know, institution that really is kind of like the birthplace of, you know, everything we love about the idea of the university. You know, because we love the idea, you know, we have our issues with the institution, but the it's just going to be absolutely amazing to be able to walk on its grounds, much less to do an event there. And so thank you for making that possible. And then let's just, because we're kind of doing this weird order where it's just like following the, since Cadell, you're going to be there at the final event, but you're also going to be there at the first event. So maybe you could talk a little bit about being the Philosophy Portal opening its arms and being the sort of welcoming and sending off a committee and everything that you're doing. You got to run, Nina. Okay. Bye bye. Yeah.
Bye, Nina. Yeah, no, this is going to be great. And it's been a long time coming. With these online collaborations, you never know when the chance is going to come to link up in the physical. So I'm really looking forward to just meet you guys, spend some time with you guys in the physical. I think it does really matter that we take the time not just to organize online, but to organize physically as well. And so, yeah, Philosophy Portal, Theory Underground are going to be opening up the tour. Paris and both of the first two events there, the one in Paris, the one in Brussels, unfortunately, they're both sold out. So I don't want to just sort of give like descriptions about how awesome they're going to be. And then like people are like, oh, crap, it can't come. But yeah, I mean, there is a lot of stuff in history going on behind these two events, actually. So maybe I could just detail a little bit that history, a little bit what's going on behind the scenes offline for me.
Which
and how these which is, events lined up.
Oh, sorry. It's just my corny joke. I was going to say it's fitting because you are, of course, broadcasting from the Freud Museum. So, you know, a little history lesson seems exactly to be in order.
No, they always let me in. Yeah, they're super kind. So Paris. Is basically it's going to be like imagine just the archetype of a bourgeois Parisian salon, and that's basically where we're going to be spending our night. It's at sort of a friend's house and a collaborator's house. I've been participating in her events called the Absolute Salon, which are basically just book clubs about the absolute. So like every month I'll go to this salon and we have a sort of recommended reading for the month and we get together with a bunch of Parisian intellectuals and discuss the absolute. And it's sort of been my secret hope over this time that when you guys were going to do your European tour, I was like, we have to find some way to link up the Absolute Salon with the Theory Underground tour. So that's just basically the seed I'm trying to plant here is trying to link up the Absolute Salon with the Theory Underground tour. And I think that where we've sort of converged on this idea is thinking about the absolute, obviously, in the context of time energy. And here, like my first sort of connecting point is in your own work, Dave, you sort of talk about how time energy is sort of a non-negotiable first principle for you in regards to your political economic activities, thought, philosophy. And so at functioning as that first principle, it's functioning as kind of an absolute principle. It's the starting point from which we think through different relationships, whether they're secular, whether they're theological, whether they're left, whether they're right, whether they're communist, whether they're neoliberal. We are trying to center and foreground the issue of time energy as sort of more fundamental than all of those other distinctions. And so that will be really productive, I think. That will be a really fun night. And then on the Brussels side of things, we're going to have more of an, I think it's going to be more like an extended week where we're going to have a group of people that are going to come together for two events. And this is in collaboration with another friend of Philosophy Portal, Joris de Kelver. Who's got a project called the Multiversity, which is still sort of maybe ill-defined, but it's basically just this space where he's organizing alternative educational opportunities outside of the university. One of the most interesting things with Joris and that project is that Joris is an ex-banker. He, from his own sort of narrative story, he talks about that he has jumped out of the golden cage that was his banking position, and has thrown himself into the void And that's sort of been his connection to Philosophy Portal for the last few years, basically just trying to reassess his entire life approach, trying to reassess his own relationship to money, to power, to careerism, to many of the things you were talking about, or at, oh, also that Nina was talking about the intellectual class, and as you talk about in your book, the PMCs. And it takes a lot of courage to do, like, it takes an enormous amount of courage to do that, to not only recognize, hey, I'm in this middle class, intellectual class cage where I have security, I have sort of financial peace of mind, but I don't have my spirit, I don't have my creativity. And that's really what Joris embodies in his work. And so what we're just trying to open up there are some more longer form workshop days where we try to workshop some of the principles that he's been working with in his commons work. He's more in the working in a commons organization now, and a business that's oriented by commons logic as opposed to capitalist logic, of course, profit maximization. And this is just very experimental. So where are the interconnections between commons logic and time energy? That will be another sort of major theme. So all in all, that's the start of the tour I just cannot wait. It's going to be a blast, and it's coming a lot faster than, you know, it's like 2 weeks away. So I'm just super pumped.
One of the things I love about Joris is that he's the first person to read Time Energy who was like, that's me. I'm the Renegade PMC. It's like, so far, it's like, there's all kinds of, you know, functionally Renegade PMC types who do stuff with us. Like, I consider Todd and Catrone and Zizek to be, like, they're all in their own way striking out and helping people in the underground and, like, just getting stuff to us, like, equipping us, you know, for what we do. And so in their own ways, they all are, but none of them identify that way. And it's like for Joris, it was like he read about it and he said it was like this light bulb moment where he was like, oh, this is describing all of like the mode and mindset and values of like what I hated about what I was in that was like killing, as you said, his spirit. And so, yeah, we're really, really excited for that connection. And then, yeah, then you'll be there for the Consciousness Museum, the Museum of Consciousness on the other side. So, you know, really bookending the whole thing. By the way, for a quick sec here, want to say welcome to Christopher. Are you smoking a cigarette that is literally blue? Like, is that a blue? It looks like an actual cigarette. Is it an e-cig?
No. It is actually a cigarette, but my camera, my laptop is a fairly old person, and the camera has decided that the cigarette will now be blue. Yeah.
Okay.
But hello, everyone.
I was like, are you joining from like the upside down or something? Like, you're cool, man. Well, great to have you. So, Christopher is someone who swept in last minute, way past the time that we were taking applications to make things happen. And I'd already told like 10 people, sorry, we won't be able to come to your city. It's too late. But the thing about Christopher was he's like, look, I've already got this organization. I've already got these venues. We're going to apply for funding. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And we'd already kind of put it out there to the universe of theory. We said, you know, roll the red carpet out for us and we'll see what we can do, you know? And so you've really been doing it. And I think it's awesome. And also, look, you and Cadell are both in the Missing Tooth gang. So it's awesome that who called a street reason? Oh, no, you got to fix Cadell. Oh, my bad. You just got it fixed. Okay. Well, last week, not too long ago, he was right there with you. So, it makes us look cooler, I think. But anyway, with that said, I think the order we're going in here, Christopher, it'll be Wukach. We'll say a few things about Krakow and his philosophical and psychoanalytic, student division. I know I got the name wrong kind of here, Wukach. I don't know if that works, but like,
it's good.
The other version was too long to fit, so I kind of truncated it. Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about your, your group and what you guys have been doing and this event?
So I'm Łukasz Siewski. I've been studying philosophy for a few years, and I got involved with Fury Underground like a few months ago, took courses. And when they proposed the tour, I just couldn't resist and proposed a meeting in Krakow. The division, my student division, you know, I just sent you this name because you asked last minute, and I was like, this is, I have a reading group, so this is its name. It's me and colleagues from the university. We read books every week. We've been doing it for like a year now. And we do it in this place, Piwnica Powszechna. It's a nice space in the middle of the city. It's open for free for everyone to come in and do their things. So I thought it would be perfect. And yeah, about the meeting, I would like to propose a little paper I've worked on from our CMT research cohort at Fury Underground on the relations between text mediums, the phone, and how when we switch to texting, we kind of lose the voice, but kind of super ego in the psychoanalytic sense intensifies, and you get more tensions, more anxiety, because I'm interested in anxiety and tension. And that's my research. That's what I research. And psychoanalysis is useful for me in that. And I would like you guys to talk about Fury Underground, because I want to invite like students and also, but also like people from outside uni and maybe two or three like doctors or professors. And I would like just like to show students that, like, because I'm not interested in researching like in a graduate program. And that's why Fury Underground is like a heaven to me, because I want to do philosophy, but I don't really want to like do it in the uni. And I want to show people that this can be done, and it can be done better than we are doing it in Krakow, which is a lot to say, because Krakow actually has a good philosophy department, but it's still like pretty I'm nonplussed after 5 years. So yeah,
it's like kind of one of those things where at the university it's like there's these wonderful professors or really cool groups, but like they are always this exception to the general rule, which means that there's so much like swimming upstream, right? And it's like, well, we're out here, it's still swimming upstream, it's you know, because of the medium. And Nance, you're going to be presenting at, if not every stop along the tour, definitely, obviously, Krakow. And so I'm just, maybe you could say some things about some of these events and your thoughts about things you're developing in terms of stuff you'll be presenting or whatever, you know. Or just how you want to skateboard the whole time, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I'm actually really excited to be able to go skateboard.
I want to see you skateboarding. Sorry, but
yeah, it's gonna be really cool. I get to go to places in the world I never thought I'd be able to go. A while ago, when I got my passport, I was talking to Dave about how it made me feel stupid because I felt so excited to have a passport. Like I've been to Iraq and I've been to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. And I spent some time in Germany for the army, but like that was world travel for me as a working class asshole. So now, like on the back end of all this, getting a passport and like traveling and seeing the world for real, like the passport was just like this symbolic thing that like I felt cool and special. And then I felt stupid for feeling special. And it was this whole thing. But no, I'm very excited to travel. To these places with tons of history and be in the physical places. But I think there's like a meta narrative for all the things that I want to talk about. And it kind of centers around intelligence and how we're using all these different forms of media to instrumentalize ourselves. And like we're getting it all wrong. Like we're focused on the instrumentality of it all and really instrumental reason. And we don't have a good grasp on human intelligence itself. And here we are in the age of AI. And some people think it's going to save the world. Some people think it's going to destroy the world. Really, it's all just like economic at this point. It's like nothing real is actually happening. But because capital has us all as our balls in a vice, all this like economic activity really does change the world. But yeah, like I think just talking about intelligence in these different frameworks and different contexts is what I'll be doing most of the time. And I'm excited about it. I'm excited to see everybody, meet everybody, breathe some fresh air, get out of Arizona because it's already hot. So I'm hoping it's less hot in all these places.
And now after we finish with the introductions, it's going to be fair game. Everybody will be able to ask each other questions or say additional things. Like, I'm really excited to hear Carl talk a little bit about hyperhumanism and the work he's doing on that, because I think that's fucking fascinating and a neglected area of research. But really quick, Christopher, yeah, if you want to introduce yourself, talk about your student or your org and how you got involved with all of this.
Yeah, so the thing was I came across Theory Underground through the interview you did with Bram in Glasgow. And when you mentioned in the interview that you were going on a European tour, I got really, really excited. And I immediately messaged Bram and was like, yo, put me in contact with these people. I really want to get them to Vienna. And then I sort of heard in the interview, yeah, it's in May. And I'm like, oh, well, okay. Well, at least I wrote them, right?
Yeah.
But so when you then replied and were like, yeah, no, this actually might work out, we got really excited. So the thing is, so I'm coming at this a lot more from a much more decidedly political standpoint, essentially. I helped restart an anarchist media collective slightly over half a year ago or something. And it's been going really well. It's been growing and growing and growing. We've gotten to a point where we actually now have local factions of this as well. Because the entire thought behind it was that I very, very deeply believe that the problem that leftists right now are facing is not necessarily the infighting happening within the leftist scene, as much as that is the case, but that has always been the case. What is happening right now is the fact that there is no international collaboration whatsoever, and people just don't talk to each other anymore. So my thought behind restarting and helping restart this platform was very much an issue of internationalism and trying to restart a conversation between people that are spread out, and just an exchange of ideas between people that do not reside in the same lived realities that we have here, for instance. So when I heard that interview that you did with Bram, the entire idea of anti-intellectualism, particularly because a lot of my family is actually from the States, and I do travel to the US not regularly, but every now and again, it is something that is extremely important to me, because like I studied English philology, and I never finished my degree, but I now work as a translator, and I work with a lot of texts that are things that people deal with in the realm of philosophy. So I'm like, just, I know what you're on about. I just never finished my degree, but it's fine. I still understand. And that's why it's something that is very, very important to me that the academics of the academic aspect of this whole thing is not what we're focused on. And that's why I also really wanted to get you to come to Vienna, because I have the feeling the particularly the left wing in Austria is sort of resides in like an ivory tower, essentially. And I mean, that is something that I guess you could say for a lot of Western Europe, but like there is such a large discrepancy between people who deal with this and people who are actually affected by it. There has to be some connection there, and I'm very, very passionate about trying to create a bridge there and sort of get people to say, look, these, we can do it. Like, it's not that fucking hard, essentially.
That's our whole goal, man. It's just to make people go, oh, look, if Dave and Nance can do it, then like, I guess I could do it too, you know, like, these American idiots.
I was, that was not what I wanted to say. But cool. Yeah, so like that is an extremely important point to sort of just get. And that's why also the venue in Vienna is decidedly a venue that is not within those academic circles. They will have to go there. Like, and that was very, very important to me to do that as well.
I kind of want to really quick just segue that over to Cadell, because you had situated the you know, the sort of kickoff event as well, being well, let's say, you know, as far as recommended reading material, like initially you had in mind the Scene to Milieu piece that I'm publishing with Philosophy Portal in your upcoming anthology, which you obviously should plug. But why did you think we should lead off with that, and how does it relate to doing stuff in person, not just online?
Well, Scene to Milieu's been kind of like a meme there, that it's been a successful meme, and you know, that's sort of hats off to you as an intellectual in general. I feel like whenever you develop an idea, you do really do it in such a way as that you develop what proves to be a pretty socially effective meme. And Scene to Milieu is a perfect example of that. And it's proved very intuitive and intellectually useful for almost everyone who comes into contact with it. I think the general idea here is that scenes, you know, here derived from like thinking about scene kids, as you point towards in your piece, are kind of built around affinity groups and mirroring each other in such a way as that there's sort of like an immediate sense of group identity, but there's not really the capacity for a real intellectual mediation. So I would personally, in my own, so in like the Logic for the Global Brain, I would link Scene to Milieu as immediacy to mediation, basically being willing to put in the conceptual work that's required to build a real space of intellectual difference. And I think that theory, and that's sort of been, you know, it sort of captures the underlying motive for why, as someone building his own sort of intellectual education platform, I reached out to you, is because I wanted to be a part of a milieu, not just a scene. And the conditions of the possibility to be a part of a milieu and not just a scene is that you're actually interacting with other organizations that are on the same level as you. You're not just interacting with either people who have no socio-political power or stakes in the process. I think that's quite difficult for where we're at, like intellectually, both in academia. I see the regression towards more scenes within departments as opposed to milieu. In my old doctoral department at the VUB, there's this merger between philosophy departments, and they both claim to be interdisciplinary philosophy departments, but they don't interact with each other, and they refuse to interact with each other. So there's that performative contradiction at work. And then online, there are a lot of people who are building sort of YouTube platforms or offering sort of different intellectual services, but they do a generally poor job of interacting with other platforms. And as a consequence, they just prefer to stay within and I know that's hard to do, and there are real political differences, and it's not just sort of, and the milieu is not just a situation where everyone gets along and everything's harmonious and, right. And stuff like that. There are real differences, and that's irreducible, and that's politics. But at the same time, there has to be some striving for holding a intellectual space of difference, and trying to network and organize with other people who are doing a similar thing to you, so that there can be an ecology of thought instead of a sort of, let's say, an isolated ivory tower of thought, or a replication of an isolated ivory tower of thought. And I sort of hold myself to that standard. And I think the link with Theory Underground is the best example yet of that project or that standard coming into actuality.
And it's not always easy, because people will misrecognize or compare and contrast us in ways that grates on us, because we're each doing our own thing. And but there are these ways that we can do stuff synergistically, as long as we know what it is. And I think that knowing what it is the reason why it matters so much to me and Nance when it comes to the tour side of things. It's like, we both come from, you know, something profoundly shaped by the 1970s and 80s underground music, you know, hardcore scene. You know, we, our entire youths, but each of us, our respective youth in our own kind of scene, is something that it wouldn't have been a place for us to grow, you know, or to maybe we weren't always growing, who knows, you know, but like it kept us out of trouble in a lot of cases in a more productive way, I think, you know. But like that whole scene, like the point was like going places and getting to know people and staying there a while. And it's like, though we're doing it in a somewhat different, a very different way, we're not just partying and we're not just throwing things and whatever, you know, it's not the same, but we're kind of in the same spirit. It's like, no, you gotta go out and actually meet people. And, you know, if that means like going 6 hours out of your way to link up with three people because you think they're fucking awesome, and Capital is saying, don't do it. You say, fuck that. I'm going to do it, man. We're going to meet that person. And, we don't care if that's a nobody. We're fucking nobodies too, man. We don't care. We're going to do it. And we're going to show them that nobodies can do this, right? And like that sort of, DIY hardcore vibe is like part of the why it matters to meet people, but also just like, man, you got to actually vibe check people, and you can't do it online really. And it's like, we did it in the US, and it's like, oh, we got the vibe in some cases. Now we fucking know, right? When it's just screens and it's all leveled out, it's like, you don't really know where a person's at, but once you've sat with them, it's like, oh, okay. Now I know where they're at. And it's like, everyone in the scene online, they're just like, oh, you got to talk to this person. Oh, you got to talk to that person. Oh, you got to talk to this person. And it's like, yeah, but if we were like all in a place in real life, like all of us embodied, you wouldn't be running up and saying, hey, you should go talk to this person. You would already know what it is. You know what I mean? And so there's just so much unspoken stuff that's hard to put to words, but people getting the feel for it, I think it's very important. I don't know, Nance, is there anything you'd want to add to that whole, that strain that we kind of often don't bring up?
Yeah, just that like this whatever the hell it even is work that needs to be done. And it's like, it not only is it disincentivized, but it's made impossible by material and structural conditions. Like, we just can't get outside of, you know, it's not even about traveling and meeting new people. It's about leaving your fucking house and living in your local world. Like, we've all been de-worlded. It's impossible to fucking to do anything anymore. And it needs to be done. And it, like, I mean, to go back to yesterday, I was saying it's terrifying and it's this and it's that. Well, it is terrifying. It is scary. It is super difficult. Because it's room that doesn't, I mean, it does exist, but it's like a crack in the door that we're trying to force open so that other people can come along and help us, you know, break the fucker down and we can build a house. We don't have houses anymore. We have fucking devices. And everyone that's involved, from the audience who watches to the people who are actually, you know, in cases bending over backwards to make something possible, like, thank you all for the opportunity, but also thank you for recognizing the necessity of what's trying to be done right now.
I also just want to add on the physical angle, again, in sort of the spirit of that immediacy to mediation, is that part of what you're talking about, I think, or trying to communicate there, Dave, with the physical angle and the vibe check stuff, is that we have to, because the internet just is these disembodied screens and you can meet everyone, right? We have to purposefully reintroduce friction. And what I mean by purposefully reintroduce friction is, like, actually doing physical events is introducing a massive amount of friction, because you have to get, like, train tickets, hostels, you have to, you know, go on planes, you know, you're organizing physically is introducing friction to the screen economy. And I think that matters, because you sort of artificially create distance and resistance in a digital sort of screen economy, which is expecting complete sort of a frictionless and zero distance between everyone. And I think that's an important dimension of, with these milieus and forming these milieus, the physical dimension is what actually necessarily slows us down and necessitates the mediation and the patience of the concept, so that we can make these things more real and more tangible than things that are being organized among people purely virtually. Because I think the people who are organizing things purely virtually are just being incentivized by the mechanics of the screen economy, which are basically attentionalist in their nature. And the opposite of the attentionalist direction is a relational direction, which necessarily introduces friction. It's not necessarily the quantity of attention, but the quality of attention that we're looking for. And I think that's another dimension where this project embodies the scene to milieu direction.
Yeah, just to add to what Cadell's saying, I think it's Zizek talks about the digital distance, that we all feel safe because we've got everyone's there, right? Everyone's there, everything's still there, everything's okay. But it's like, it's actually the indigenous that will survive, likely, what's coming, you know, and it's the skills, it's the foraging, it's the getting in the nitty-gritty. And as Cadell says, I always talk about this idea that it's this one button solution to everything. Get me a girlfriend, get me a job, get me a hotel, get me a house. And like Nance says, we don't have houses anymore. We have devices, and it doesn't matter where you are, because everyone's on this tiny little bit of real estate, and we've been zombified by those technologies. And the love of your life walks past, and you don't even see them. You know, you don't even see them. So it's for me, it's really, how do we become hyperhuman, realizing that we're not even human yet? We may have actually become less human because of the atrophication of all these technologies. These technologies have taken away our humanity, robbed us of our vitality. So it's this human flourishing that I think we're all hungry for. And how do we really maintain our humanity in the face of this disintegration of society? And I think that, yeah, for me, it's like, it's an open door. And people are hungry for it, and they need a counterpoint to transhumanism, because everyone's starting to think, fuck, it's inevitable that I'm going to be made redundant as a human. But what people don't know is that what's super interesting now is that AI is already starting to eat itself in this cannibalistic, like the snake eating its tail, because I heard a stat that 30% of the internet is already generative AI created. And when the model that you're feeding feeding on is the entire internet, when it starts to eat itself, it starts to hallucinate. And therefore, you are not getting anywhere with AI. AI starts to plateau. So it kind of needs us. It needs human creativity to continuously be refreshed in order for it to flourish. So it is this symbiotic relationship with AI. Because we built AI. It's not some sentient other. It's us. It's all of human culture that's being fed into this machine learning algorithm. There is no AI. We need people to understand that it's, as Gerard Lanier says, it's like, it's not so much the technology. This is just the latest disruptive technology that we're within. It's not the technology. It's how we perceive the technology. That's the problem. And we will be driven mad before we're human. Before we become human. So it's really a case of like making sure that we keep everything in perspective, feed the blue collar workers the simple message that AI is not going to take your jobs because it needs you. It needs us to be creative. It needs us to be in our imaginations for it to work.
I mean, in that respect, I work as a translator, so I am fairly afraid of AI, to be perfectly honest. But in regards to what you were just saying, I recently learned the term Habsburg AI, which I find incredibly funny. So the idea that AI is informed by generative text by other large language models. And that then, that's how AI just becomes utterly useless, because like if it informs itself, it's just a thing that does whatever the fuck it's doing. Like, but particularly in terms of the physicality of the events, one of the things that I did absolutely want to mention was the venue where we will be hosting the talk in Linz, Willy Fredshaus, is a housing project that is very, very decidedly, that was decidedly formed in order to be able to have spaces. That is something that I do think is an extremely important point to point out at this point as well. Like the availability of physical space is not something to be taken for granted, particularly in Western Europe at this point. Like Dublin is one of the most, if not the most expensive city in the world at this point, in terms of living costs. And it just keeps on piling up, essentially. And there is absolutely a need for an alternative way of thinking about housing and thinking about the fact that, fucking living space should very much be a human right. Like, humans need to be somewhere, and as long as we are continuing down this path of privatization of fucking everything, that will only result in more and more houseless people, more and more conflict, more and more friction, as you were saying beforehand, and that is not something. But that is not a point where we should be heading towards. Like, people have to live somewhere. And the housing project in Linz is, they bought a house based on micro loans, essentially, and were able to purchase this house. They live in this house, they maintain it themselves. And sort of pay rent, so to say, in order to pay off what they got. They get microloans every now and again in order to be able to have the funds to maintain a place. And then invariably, once they've paid off all the loans, they will still keep paying rent in order to pay for other other projects to do that. And that is an extremely important and, to my mind, absolutely beautiful project in how to sort of work against gentrification, that you don't buy a house in order to tear it down and build apartments that nobody can fucking afford, and then eventually the working class will have to live in the suburbs and pay by gauze how much to get to their jobs. And like, it's living in Vienna, this is a really, really important and very, very very, very actual thing on my mind right now, because like, I just the other day I just saw a video of private security companies harassing people in houses and essentially dismantling their doors so that people will leave, just because the owner of the house wants to get them out. And like, that's what I mean, like the physicality of events, the essence of being in a place and being able to talk with other people within that community is an extremely important factor. And I don't think that I would get a lot of people interested in what you're doing essentially in Linz would you not go there. And the fact that this house is being able to host that is an extremely important factor.
Thanks, man. Yeah, no, by the way, yes, I am recording, Carl. It's all through OBS. So I know it's like, you probably like had this start where you're like, wait a minute, it doesn't say it's recording, because it's, you know, on Zoom, you're used to seeing it say that, right? So it looks like Cadell had to dip. Unless I'm just not seeing when people turn their cameras off. I'm not sure. But either way, we're about to close this thing out in the next like 2 minutes. And I think, yeah, when it comes to direct action and mutual aid and like the sort of anarchist thing and everything with like squats and microloans and or what Joris is doing, which seems somewhat related, but on a much bigger scale, where he's doing this commons project where it's like homeowners working together to like buy out stuff, and so they're not constantly paying rent. It's like, I think I see all of this as like if you know people that you can band together with and make something work to your advantage, like do it 100%. And is that our way out? Like, I hope not. I hope that there's going to be bigger structural changes, but you're right. It's not going to happen without like international cooperation between people who aren't just hanging out at Davos, or people who aren't just hanging out in like these. I know it takes real people who have grown up paying actual rent and whose, you know, families were broken because their parents were too stressed trying to pay bills and not be able to have relationships with their kids and shit. Like, if it's not coming from that, then it's always just going to be this fucking rich boy aesthete bullshit where it's like, oh yeah, let's fucking talk about our orgasms and shit. It's like, fuck off, dude, man. Like, I don't give a shit. Like, have fun. But like, we're trying to like talk about not just bread, you know, like man doesn't live by bread alone, right? But we're talking about like real lives here. We're talking about like the ability to be human. And yeah, when we're thinking about like spaces, physical spaces, it's so hard. It's so hard to get a real physical space. And some people have no respect for the importance of it, really. They're like, why don't you just do everything over Zoom? And you know, you get it a lot with like these anti-intellectual critiques of environmentalists. I have all kinds of critiques of environmentalists, like to no end. But the one that's the dumbest fucking critique in the whole world is like, oh, they fly everywhere. How hypocritical. Dude, people need to meet. You think everyone should spend their whole life over Zoom? Shut up, man. You got a problem with Greta Thunberg? Fucking say something else. Say something that's smart. And that's the thing, is it takes American idiots to call out idiocy at the end of the day. Like, yeah, Fuck Greta Thunberg, but guess what? People need to fly places, so don't have a stupid ass argument like that. Come up with something better. And I also don't mean actually, like, I don't have a problem with her. I don't have a real opinion on the matter, but I'm just saying, like, better your arguments, people. Physical stuff matters. And this whole, like, let it all melt into air. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's going to, but in the meantime, where are we going to be though? And it's like, you look at a whole city like Berlin, how hard it was for us to find a space, even though there's all of these ancient commune type, you know, buildings that host events. It's still so hard to just do something. It's like, we just need a space. What's so hard about that? So, you know, but it's amazing that, you know, you find one in a squat. Carl finds one at Oxford University. At the end of the day, it's like, whoa, that's amazing. So I'll let you each take some closing thoughts and we'll close it out. Yeah. But don't everyone rush to go at once.
There's one. I'm very, very sorry for being late. I was caught up. Longer story is, like, everything I've been reading, all the theories that I've come up with that I was confronted with, all come from people that wrote shit while they were working or after they were working. They were not part of the intellectual class. The intellectual class was the fucking aristocracy. It's an extremely important thing to keep that in mind and keep on sort of pushing the idea that we can think. We're not stupid. Like, we might not be the aristocracy, we might not have the means to work to not work and just deal with theory, but we still fucking can. That's why I feel like it's extremely important to bring this to particularly bring this to Austria and sort of show all these people living in their ivory towers to some extent, like, no, that's not something that we have to do. We can actually deal with this shit. And as a person who stopped, who ended his time at university before I got my degree, that is extremely important to me as well. Like, I do know my shit. I might not have the title to show it, but I do. And yeah.
So thank you, man. Thank you.
Yeah,
yeah, well, we're stoked, man. Thank you. Yeah, we're really stoked. Carl, got anything before we close out?
Yeah, just really grateful to be even being on this stream, but let alone to be hosting events with you. And really, really think the time energy question is so apt. And it strikes me that the PMCs and the blue collar workers all struggle with their time energy. And for me, it's a question of, we need to meet. Like, people need to meet. And the fact is, we've been brainwashed into thinking that we don't. And that it's all fine just to not have a physical reality anymore. It's like de-worlding, completely right from Nance. And let's build the world back better.
Build it back better. Yeah. I love that. And this is ultimately an invitation for everybody, to go from cybernet to organic net. And, you know, in a sort of sense, the organic net is something that's never really, set in stone. It forms over time. People form relationships and break relationships off, you know, and, like, sometimes you have a friend that you don't talk to for 5 years because you're working through something or whatever. But, like, that's on the organic side. How do you bring people from the cyber side into the organic side? It can be crazy and it can be surprising, but it could also be beautiful. And, we're on this weird edge, pioneering something that is going to be hopefully very normal over the next 20 to 50 years of people figuring out how to hybridize it and how to move from one to the other. And along with that, we'll learn etiquette and norms that haven't been invented yet, but need to be. And that's part of the reason people feel so neurotic and anxious about all of this stuff. And so, thank you guys for being courageous, or at least, oblivious, and pushing past all of that anxiety and neuroticism. So thank you for being here. Nance, you get the last word, man.
Yeah, just to reiterate again, thank you guys. I think it's pretty dope. I think it's pretty radical. I think it's all the cool things, and I'm very much looking forward to being in physical space with you guys. Thank you so much.